This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The IAEA says that it can only estimate Iran's nuclear stockpile. AP correspondent Mike Gracia with details.
The United Nations Atomic Watchdog reported Monday, at present, it can only estimate Iran's overall nuclear stockpile because it hasn't had access to monitoring data since February. Iran began limiting inspections on February 23rd in a bid to pressure President Joe Biden to lift sanctions reimposed by President Donald Trump in 2018. Trump's action coincided with his decision to pull the U.S. out of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. The International Atomic Energy Agency's confidential report was seen by the Associated Press. The report estimates as of May 22nd, Iran's total enriched uranium stockpile was 3,241 kilograms, up about 273 kilograms from the last quarterly report. Talks are ongoing in Vienna for the U.S. to rejoin the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. I'm Mike Gracia.
Israel's defense minister has distanced himself from comments made by his military chief after Israel bombed a Gaza Strip high-rise housing, an Associated Press office, and other news outlets. Benny Gantz says that the remarks were not meant to be taken literally. In a published interview over the weekend, the Lieutenant General Aviv Kohavi was quoted as saying that AP journalists drank coffee each morning with Hamas operatives in a cafeteria in that building. The AP has called the claims patently false, noting there wasn't even a cafeteria in the building. Speaking to foreign reporters on Monday, Gantz said that Kohavi was just trying to portray the atmosphere, not the actual aspects of the building. This is VOA News. A new study is blaming climate change for 37% of global heat deaths. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
More than one-third of the world's heat deaths each year are due directly to global warming. That's according to the latest study to calculate the human cost of climate change. Dozens of researchers who looked at heat deaths in 732 cities around the globe from 1991 to 2018 calculated that 37% were due to higher temperatures from human-caused warming. The study in the journal Nature Climate Change found about 35% of heat deaths in the U.S. can be blamed on climate change. That's a total of more than 1,100 deaths a year in about 200 cities. I'm Shelley Adler.
Imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has asked a court to halt the hourly nighttime checks he has been subjected to in his penal colony. Speaking Monday in a video link from prison, Navalny charged that he has done nothing that would warrant the authorities' decision to designate him a flight risk that has resulted in the checks. He argued that the hourly nighttime checks effectively amount to torture, telling the judge that you would go mad in a week if subjected to such a regular wake-up. Navalny was arrested in January upon his return from Germany, where he had spent 5 months recovering from the nerve agent poisoning that he blames on the Kremlin. And these are accusations that the Kremlin reject. An increasing number of American citizens have been apprehended as they have tried to smuggle illegal drugs into the U.S. since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. For more than a year, the closure of the U.S.-Mexico border to non-essential traffic has limited the number of foreign citizens entering the U.S. by land. The rules have been extended until at least June 21st. But Mexican authorities have allowed most U.S. citizens to walk or drive south across the border with relative ease. Law enforcement officials and drug trafficking experts say that the border rules and their lopsided enforcement are driving the rise in U.S. citizens involved in border drug busts. Vietnam plans to test all 9 million people in its largest city for the coronavirus and impose more restrictions to deal with the growing COVID-19 outbreak. People in Ho Chi Minh City for the next 2 weeks are only allowed to leave home for necessary activities, and public gatherings of more than 10 people are banned. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundian President Ndayishimiye is on a two-day visit to Kenya.
I wish to take this opportunity to once again thank you for your personal involvement in our recent political achievements and the role of your country, Kenya, in the Burundi peace process.
Nigeria's Election Commission offices come under attack. The chair of Liberia's former Truth and Reconciliation Commission will comment on the clamor for a war crimes court in Liberia. Cameroon's government investigates over $300 million in missing COVID-19 funds. And Zambian doctors demand unconditional release of their jailed members.
We are asking the government to release our arrested Secretary General without any conditions, because he hasn't done anything criminal and he is not supposed to be detained for what is rightfully his.
An activist in Tanzania urged their government to begin COVID-19 vaccination. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Uhuru Kenyatta on Monday welcomed Burundian President Evariste Ndayishimiye at the Kisumu State Lodge for a two-day visit to Kenya. President Ndayishimiye will be the guest of honor today, Tuesday, as Kenya celebrates the 58th Madaraka Day to commemorate internal self-rule in 1963. Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
President Ndayishimiye made history as the first head of state to arrive in Kenya via Kisumu International Airport yesterday morning aboard a Kenya Airways flight. The Burundian leader was accorded a presidential reception complete with a guard of honor at State House Lodge Kisumu by his host, President Kenyatta. Later, the two leaders signed numerous bilateral agreements aimed at strengthening trade ties between Kenya and Burundi, including agriculture, public service, foreign affairs, trade, sports, and culture. President Ndayishimiye acknowledged Kenya's efforts in helping Burundi sustain peace through Kenya's participation in international peacekeeping efforts.
Your Excellency, as you know, following the successful general election held last year, Burundi has regained peace, security, and stability. Burundi is no longer in the UN Security Council agenda and in the political agenda of the AU Peace and Security Council. I wish to take this opportunity to once again thank you for your personal involvement in our recent political achievements and the role of your country, Kenya, in the Burundi peace process.
President Kenyatta said the two countries have agreed to strengthen their long-lasting fraternal relations with the aim of promoting an endless socioeconomic development. He said there are vast untapped business opportunities between Bujumbura and Nairobi, and directed relevant ministries to review and address bottlenecks hindering the growth of trade and investment between the two countries.
Cooperation between our two countries is built on a solid foundation of shared values and principles to foster sustainable social economic development and transformation of our two countries, and also a vibrant and united East African community, as well as an integrated and prosperous Africa.
President Kenyatta is chair of the East African Community, and some analysts see the Burundian president's visit as the latest move by President Kenyatta to bring the community together. In the last month, President Kenyatta hosted Tanzania's President Samia Suluhu and attended Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's inauguration. Professor Chacha Nyaigoti Chacha, an expert in international relations and diplomacy, says it's important for President Ndayishimiye's new government to open up to its neighbors and other African countries.
And I think it's important to use this opportunity to bring together the countries of East Africa. And this opportunity for Burundi also allows the new regime in Burundi, because Burundi has had some challenges. And the new regime in Burundi now is trying to open up to make contacts with the neighboring countries as well as other African countries for its own sake, prosperity and peace.
President Ndayishimiye will be the guest of honor today, Tuesday, as Kenya celebrates its 58th Madaraka Day at the new Jomo Kenyatta International Stadium in Kisumu. Madaraka, which is Swahili for authority, is celebrated every June 1st to commemorate the day that Kenya attained internal self-rule in 1963. Kenya went on to gain full independence on December 12, 1963. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
The president of the Resident Doctors Association of Zambia is demanding the immediate and unconditional release of members of the group who have been arrested by the police. Dr. Brian Sampa says it is unacceptable for doctors to be arrested for demanding improved working conditions. He says the doctors went on strike last week after the government failed to address their concerns despite repeated promises to do so. The demands include payment of monies owed to the doctors and employment of 500 doctors to ease the workload of the physicians. But critics say the strike is aimed at making President Edgar Lungu's government unpopular ahead of the upcoming August 12 general election. Dr. Sampa spoke with viewers Peter Clotty for more on the doctor's strike.
So we are asking the government to release our arrested Secretary General without any conditions, because he hasn't done anything criminal. And he is not supposed to be detained just for what is rightfully his.
What are some of the concerns you have for which you embarked on this strike?
From 2015 to date, more than 1,500 Zambian doctors have been owed personal emoluments in form of salary arrears, settling in allowances, and gratuities. We also have a shortage of doctors because the ratio of patient to doctor in Zambia is 1 to 12,000. Meanwhile, the acceptable ratio, according to WHO, is supposed to be 1 to 1,000, which is at least not stressful for the doctors to cater for the patients. So looking at that ratio, already there's a compromise on quality health care because we have very few doctors. So our demand is to improve the healthcare delivery system by employment of more doctors. And we want to do this as we lobby for the more than 500 doctors who are just in the streets. These doctors need to be employed.
Some people are saying you should have engaged the government to address some of these concerns, and that embarking on this strike pretty much imperils the healthcare delivery in Zambia. Not only that was a dangerous time when Zambia faces this global pandemic, and that withdrawing services basically cripples the healthcare delivery system. How do you respond to such criticism?
For that one, I can assure you that these engagements have been going on for so many years. Letters have been written to the government. We've sat several times with them. They haven't been responding. The time the pandemic came, the COVID-19, they even promised to give us the incentives. But up to now, they haven't given none. And we've got a lot of doctors who have even ended up dying from COVID. There is no compensation. And we fear that more doctors may just die and nothing is being done.
So what's the next line of action for your organization, since there are reports of some of your members or colleagues being arrested by the police?
What is now going to happen is that the membership had agreed that if they don't release our Secretary General, the next step would be that now the members who now do a full-blown strike where they withdraw all the services. Because right now we are on a go slow. The members are reporting for work, but they are only seeing emergencies. They are not doing routine works in the hospitals. So as we speak, that's what is on the ground. But we gave them up to today to ensure that our Secretary General is released. And these intimidations have to stop. Because as I'm telling you, even myself, I'm just hiding. The police are looking for me. And no wonder when you were calling, my phone was off because I'm fearing to be tracked.
Dr. Brian Sampa is president of the Resident Doctors Association of Zambia. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. Nigerian political observers are expressing concern over the many attacks on the facilities of Nigeria's electoral body, the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC. INEC officials say the commission has recorded at least 42 attacks on its facilities since the last polls in 2019. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
9 attacks occurred in 2019 and 21 others took place last year. But in the last 4 weeks, 12 more offices of the commission have either been set ablaze or vandalized. The latest incident occurred Sunday in southeastern Imo State. Ballot boxes, voted cubicles, power generators, and utility vehicles were destroyed. Election officials are evaluating the extent of the damage, but say an initial assessment shows it could significantly affect their ability to conduct credible elections in the affected places. Political analysts like Jibrin Ibrahim, a senior fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development, agree that attacks on facilities, coupled with Nigeria's general security challenges and separatist calls in two areas, will affect polls.
When some people are saying we want out of the nation, others are saying let's just vote and keep the nation, it becomes a difficult context to ensure that there's a level playing ground for elections.
Officials blame unidentified armed groups and the separatist group Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB, for the fresh attacks. IPOB advocates an independent state in a part of Nigeria that tried to break away more than 50 years ago. The government has not commented on the attacks. In recent months, Nigeria has seen an escalation in violence by armed criminal groups, as well as the rising profile of IPOB and another separatist movement in southwestern Nigeria. But political analyst Rotimi Olawale says insecurities can only delay elections, not hinder them.
And I'm assured that the 2023 general election would hold as scheduled. As you know, in 2019, the election was moved for a couple of weeks to allow for better management of the security architecture in the northeastern part of Nigeria. At the very worst case scenario, I suspect that the election in 2023 might also be moved for a few weeks.
Last week, INEC chief Mahmoud Yakubu declared attacks on election offices a national emergency and met with top security chiefs to address the problem. At a meeting Thursday, Nigerian security units pledged to support the commission by beefing up security around election offices. However, expert Ezeonwa Nwabu says the attacks are politically driven and will likely escalate before the next polls.
Nigerian political elite are not innovative. They have not found any other means of negotiating for power except violence. Okay? And we are going to see that towards next year, the escalation of
INEC is approaching a major gubernatorial election set for this November. Next month, the commission will begin a voter registration process for Nigeria's general polls in 2023. Experts say the security situation will determine both turnout and the credibility of the process. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 1st. The chair of the former Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC of Liberia, says the commission was a fact-finding body and not a court. Jerome Verdier says the commission investigated and made conclusions and recommendations of facts gathered based on the preponderance of evidence. This comes as calls for the establishment of a war and economic crimes court in Liberia are growing louder. Senator Prince Johnson, who fought in the Liberian Civil War and is being accused by some of alleged war crimes violations, told VOA a week ago that there are statutes in Liberia that prevent the introduction of such a court. Johnson also said it was wrong for anyone to call for the establishment of a war crimes court in Liberia on the basis of testimonies given before the Truth Commission. I asked Councillor Verdier to respond to these claims.
There's only one truth in everything Mr. Johnson has said. And when he appeared before the TRC, we told him to speak freely. We told him to share his experiences with the people of Liberia through the commission. And we told him that his testimonies would not be used against him in court. And that is the refrain we told every other person who came to the TRC. The TRC wasn't a court. It was an investigative body investigating analyzing facts and making recommendations. We were not there to convict people or to declare their guilt or innocence. We were to collect the facts, and based upon the facts, we draw conclusions and make recommendations. And our conclusions are in the CRC report that indeed all the warring factions committed brutal crimes in the country. They violated international laws. They committed war crimes. International human rights laws were violated by all the warring factions.
Counselor, what do you think Senator Johnson means when he says that there are legal and constitutional instruments that block people from bringing war crimes, quote, to Liberia? Are you aware of any laws in Liberia that provide such protection?
There's no law in Liberia that grants absolute immunity to perpetrators of war crimes that were committed during the Liberian conflict. There is a law in the Constitution that was passed by the PRC, but amnesty laws of that nature and what Mr. Johnson is referring to have no validity in international law. And Mr. Johnson made reference to such a law when he appeared before the TRC, and we told him, do you have the law? He said, yes. We said, okay, will you bring it, provide it to the commission? He said, yes, but interestingly, he didn't do. What he is exhibiting appears to be a secret law, which is against public policy.
The senator also said something about some disagreement among members of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying here.
I do understand. In any human environment dynamics, there's bound to be misunderstanding. Two commissioners, one is deceased now, Commissioner Sheeta from McConnell, and Commissioner Perbu. To the best of my recollection, the commission had 7 drafts of the final report, and one was presented as a preliminary to the legislature. And we told them we are bringing the final one, but volume 2 is just a preliminary. And in there, it said that we will be recommending for prosecution in accordance with the mandate of the TRC. The TRC make recommendation for criminal accountability, which is people should account for their crimes, and then political accountability. People should account for their political deeds that may have contributed to the war. So for criminal accountability, we recommended the War Crimes Code, the War Economic Crimes Code. For political accountability, we recommended that people not participate or be barred from taking part in public life. So in the last meeting, Commissioner Boone and Commissioner Conner said they didn't want anything to do with prosecution. So we told them, okay, you were hired to do a work for the Liberian people. So you have to let your opinion be known so that we can include it in the TRC report. In the outline of the TRC report, there is a space there for that.
Jerome Verdier is chair of the former Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC of Liberia. He's speaking with us from Washington, D.C. The president of Zanzibar, a semi-autonomous region of Tanzania, says his government will soon import COVID-19 vaccines. This puts the region at odds with the national government, which has yet to approve any COVID-19 vaccine. Opposition parties are urging the government to allow vaccinations to begin. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Zanzibar's President Hussein Mwinyi said Saturday that he will allow COVID-19 vaccines to be administered in the semi-autonomous region. He said the vaccinations, when they begin, will be both optional and safe.
Chanjo ya corona ni hiari.
Mwinyi said there will be nobody who will be forced to get a vaccination they don't want. He added, we should not accept people's sayings that if you get vaccinated, we'll die. All over the world, people have been vaccinated. He said we'll bring in the vaccine, and those who want it will be vaccinated, and those who don't won't take the shot. Former Tanzanian President John Magufuli, who died in March, denied the presence of COVID-19 in the country and dismissed the vaccines as unproven and risky. The new president, Samia Hassan, accepts the disease exists and has said she's looking to import vaccines. But still, weeks have gone by without any sign of vaccines being delivered to or administered in Tanzania. Rights activists like Deogratias Mahinyila say it's high time the government to follow the world's approach in handling the infections. He says what is being done in Zanzibar and here on the mainland should be done quickly and go with this pace. Mahinyila adds that Tanzania is not an island. Whatever we are doing should match with other countries in the world, how they are handling this. Some citizens say vaccinations will reduce the fear of infections. Jacqueline Thomas is a Dar es Salaam resident. She thinks the government should speed up allowing vaccination to be brought in Tanzania because we all know that vaccination is the main weapon to avoid a person getting ill. She says that if a person gets the COVID-19 vaccine, that means the infections will not spread and we won't live under fear. After more than a year of pandemic, Tanzania still has no figures on the numbers of COVID-19 cases or the death caused by the disease. Zanzibar's president says he'll import the vaccines by Saturday, although the details of the plan remain unclear. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Cameroon rights groups, opposition parties, and local media are asking the government to publish its findings after most of its $335 million loan from the IMF could not be accounted for. At least 15 officials have appeared before commissions of investigation. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
A government statement read on Cameroon state media Monday calls on civilians to be calm as investigations on missing funds continue. The statement from government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi states that justice will take its course. The statement comes after Cameroon rights groups and opposition asked the government to explain what happened to about $335 million loaned by the International Monetary Fund to fight COVID-19. Cameroon says within the past 1 week, 15 ministers have appeared at the audit bench of the Supreme Court and a special criminal tribunal to account for the funds. Joseph Lavoisier Tapi is legal advisor to the opposition Social Democratic Front Party and a member of the Cameroon Human Rights League.
Déjà, je voudrais relever que les ministres n'ont aucune immunité.
Tapi says the Cameroon Special Criminal Tribunal should have ordered their arrest after the audit bench of the Supreme Court found out that some ministers stole COVID-19 funds. He says the money should have been invested to save lives and assist suffering people. He says he wants to make it clear that government ministers in Cameroon do not have immunity like lawmakers. In June 2020, SDF lawmakers complained that the awarding of COVID-19 contracts did not respect procurement procedures and gave room for massive corruption. Local media like Equinox Radio and TV, Royal FM, reported gross cases of embezzlement. In one case, the Ministry of Scientific Research received $9 million to produce the drug chloroquine. The ministry instead bought chloroquine amounting to 30% of the funds from China. Other cases involve overbilling and failure to render service or provide supplies after payment. André Lucien Mecca speaks for the ruling CPDM party, to which all of the ministers called up for questioning belong.
On ne peut pas d'ores et déjà avoir des sentences et des verdicts.
Mecca says Cameroonians should stop asking for ministers to either be punished or to refund COVID-19 funds. He says Cameroon considers all suspects innocent until found guilty by the law courts. He says Cameroon President Paul Biya has a strong political will to punish everyone who has either mismanaged, embezzled, or siphoned state money. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Colotti and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.